Jim, thanks so much for doing this,
Thanks for having me, Ralph.
It's a pleasure. Congratulations on the show, by the way. I think I saw you just before it aired the first season. It's been a while.
Yeah, we're on season two. We've got 10 more episodes this season.
It is outstanding television.
Really?
It really is, yeah.
Oh, that's very nice.
I mean, obviously, you're funny, and I was rooting for you, but I started watching it out of sort of like, well, I'm going to support my friend, but now I watch it because I love the show.
Oh, that's good. Thank you. The ratings are going up very, very slowly, very gradually, but they're going in the right direction. So hopefully we'll get another season after this one, and then, you know, hopefully it'll be successful soon enough. But I think we're doing good work. I think the episodes are good. It's harder than I thought it would be.
I was going to ask you that. Is there a learning curve? Because this is unlike anything you've done before.
Yeah, really. I'm not good with the auto cue, so I basically on Monday try to memorize as much as possible before, so it looks like I'm not reading because I'm a bit dyslexic and I'm not good with the teleprompt. So that was tricky for me, but now I'm getting more used to that, and so, you know, that's okay. But when I had a sitcom, that was arguably more fun to do because it was more, you worked with other actors,
right,
and, you know, and it was also goofy. So people didn't write to you telling you that you're a libertard cuck piece of shit all the time. Or people didn't ask me constantly, how much are the left paying you to do these things? And so then you do something. I find with the show, you get attacked from the left and the right. You get attacked from both angles because I'm not doing a news show. And this idea that most of things that are called news in America, in my opinion, aren't news shows. They're opinion pieces.
Right.
Like Sean Hannity's not a news show. This is an opinion
piece.
He's
never been a journalist.
Yeah. This is a person just giving their opinions. And that's all I do. And that's all Trevor does. And that's all John Oliver does or Samantha Beater. We're all just giving our opinions on certain topics, and often you'll be up in the writer's room and the opinion will be split. And so when we write a piece, I sort of hear both sides of the argument. Sometimes you don't even know what your opinion on the thing is until the researchers have given you all the material to read. And then I go up to the writer's room and I sort of say, well, this is how I feel about it. And
you're the tiebreaker, right?
Yeah, and then they try to write around how I feel, you know what I mean? And then I add my jokes in. So right now, we just went up and did that. So today's Thursday. So sort of Friday, they'll start giving me scripts, and then Monday, we'll start polishing them, and then Tuesday, we do them, and then we start again. And there's two different subjects. And what you hope is nothing big happens on Saturday or Sunday. That fucks your Monday up.
You had to scrap everything and start all over again.
That's right. And we try not to talk about Trump. All this is Trump bashing. One of the rules is we go out of our way not to talk about Trump, but sometimes it's very difficult not to.
Yeah.
So on the last episode, we're talking about the Korean summer. So you have to do some Trump jokes in there because Trump's going to meet with Kim Jong-un. And so you can't just ignore that. And then sometimes he tweets something that's so ridiculous that you're like, fuck, I have to say something.
Well, if he's taking credit for the Koreans getting together, I mean, you can't leave him out of the story, really.
I find it so bizarre that people who get like, all you do is joke about Trump. And it's like, you don't see why he's funny? Why this guy's a funny person? And so it's the same thing as one of the writers summed it up for me the other day very well. He said, if Kim Kardashian was our president, we'd be joking about her just as much. And she would be a left-wing person who was a reality star. She's not that far removed from what Donald Trump was. She's a multimillionaire person who's a reality star. And if she became the president, we would be making the same jokes about fucking some stupid outfit she wore or some other thing she did or some she lied about a weight to a doctor would make it. You know what I mean? Like little things that is just so easy to tease him about.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you never would have done this about Obama. I didn't have a TV show when Obama was. When the show was being made, the pilot episode, we had to scrap because Trump won the election. We were writing an episode as if Hillary won the election for the pilot. In fact, we were in the writer's room watching the election play out. I remember going, oh, he's going to win. She's going to win Florida, and just going home. Like going, oh, this isn't going to be anything. She's going to, yeah. And then we all came in the next day, fuck, we have to write a whole new thing. I remember being in the office making the pilot when the Billy Bush thing broke, thinking
that
we should mention
game
that,
over, right?
And then going, then going, well, he's going to lose, so this is a non-story. It's never going to matter, and no one's ever going to talk about it. So this idea that some people say that people like me, John and Samantha, and there's more now, Michelle Wolf now, and all these different shows, we only exist because of Trump, isn't true at all. John Oliver was doing it for years before Trump got elected.
Yeah, Daily Show had been on forever.
The Daily Show was right in the meat of the Democrats having, you know, like from Bill Clinton onwards.
Yeah.
You know, but I, you know, look, it is easier to poke fun at the Republicans if you're, and I used to think I was a big lefty. I'm nowhere near as left as I thought I was.
Mm-hmm.
I used to think I was way more left. And then, you know, I got some writers who were extremely left. I got some who were a little to the right. And you know what I mean? I guess I'm somewhere in the middle, but I don't understand people who are completely left or completely right who have, their opinion, like I'm pro-choice when it comes to abortion and stuff like that, but I would never lightly get an abortion or anything like that. I think there has to be different circumstances, and there's some people who think that you should do it no matter what, and then there's some people who go, even if you get raped, you shouldn't be allowed to have one. And so I don't understand people who are, you know, I'm not even as anti-gun as people would think I am. I believe in gun control, and I believe bigger background checks, and we don't need the AR-15s and that type of stuff. And then there's the people who think there should be no guns whatsoever.
Right.
And then there's the people who should be like, no, we should have fucking bazookas if we want them, you know? So
grenade launchers.
I don't understand how everyone's – like to have the same opinion as an entire group must be fucking really boring.
And the left particularly seems to be so sensitive to everything that is said, even more so sometimes than actions.
Mm.
The politically correct aspect of no one being able to take a joke anymore that comes predominantly from the left is infuriating, I think.
The left are completely infuriating. And then sometimes what the right does that's wrong in this thing is someone will say the N-word or call someone a faggot. And then go, well, what are you trying to stop me from being? Are you PC crap? And you're like, right. No, well, that's now you're not even joking.
Yes.
You're just saying hate words. So, anytime we say anything, they try to shut us up. And I was like, it wasn't even formed into a joke.
No, you've crossed the line.
You've crossed the line. There is hate speech. There is things that, like, just being morally good isn't a left and right thing.
Right.
And I've said more offensive jokes than fucking anybody. And I know how to push buttons and all that type of bullshit. But, you know, there's like, was it Owen Benjamin just got taken off Twitter for?
Yeah.
But he's like, oh, they're trying to shut me up. It's like you said the N word a lot on there, man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And not really in a formation that makes you think, oh, this is a joke.
I made one joke about David Hogg, and it's like, yeah, but there was a lot before that.
It's all context.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know Owen that well. I know him well enough. He's always been nice enough to me, and I have nothing against the guy, but I think he may have done it by design. I think he's probably earning more money now, having people donate to a thing to hear him in the morning. Similar to what, like, sort of Anthony Cumia did after Opie and Anthony, where
yeah.
he started to do his own radio show in the morning. And I don't know about Anthony either. I don't know if Anthony's earning more money now than he did on satellite. Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. I don't know. But I'm sure now he's in a happier place because he's getting to do what he wants.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I had to do when K-Rock let me go. I'm doing this show now
right.
because, you know, you got to earn. But the problem is, I don't hate anyone nearly enough to get enough attention for people.
Exactly.
I think I'm too balanced and normal.
Yeah. Spreading love doesn't get you much attention in this world.
speaking of the show, when you touched on abortion a little bit, your field pieces are remarkably well put together and tight. The one you did with the Irish, politician.
The Eighth Amendment in Ireland.
The baby killers.
Yeah, the baby killers. The Eighth Amendment in Ireland is a thing that was brought in not too long ago, but it's basically any woman who gets an abortion should have a maximum sentence of 14 years.
Right.
You get less for rape over there.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you have an abortion, and there's people who think that the doctors should be just treated like murderers and get the death penalty and what have you. And so what happens is 12 or 14 Irish women a day travel mostly to London, some to Holland. To get abortions. And so we did this field piece. Now, that field piece sort of felt like I thank you for saying that these are such well-crafted sort of field pieces, because that one just landed in our fucking lap really well. Like, because that one we filmed part of it when I was in Ireland. So all of our field pieces are based around where's my calendar and what gigs am I doing?
So you film while you're on the road?
Yeah, yeah. So I just did a tour of Europe. So we did some in Holland. We did some in Scandinavia. We did some in Ireland. So I had a gig in Ireland. I had a gig in London. And so we interviewed, and I did a gig in London or Ireland earlier than that. Like it was 6 months earlier. And I interviewed a friend of mine called Tara Flynn. Tara Flynn's a comedian. She openly talks about her having an abortion. And then it wasn't really a piece yet. It was just me talking to someone who had an abortion. And then we found a politician over there who says that the doctors should get the death penalty on top of stuff. And so we thought it'd be funny to fly the guy. I was in Ireland the night before, and that was true. The night before I was in Ireland, I did another piece in Ireland. And then, so we just filmed ourselves at the front of their parliament and just said, we made him fly over. And we got one of our writers, and I don't know if people noticed this, but he was almost dressed the same. He was Cordell. He was based on Del Griffin from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Like, we couldn't have signposted it more.
The sandwich bit.
He had a tuna sandwich in his pocket and he took his shoes off. And the outtakes for that piece, because it was an hour long car drive and then you only see a few minutes of it, one of our writers, Forrest Shaw, played the John Candy role and just annoyed the shit out of this guy. And the Irish guy is as heinous a person as he is. I got to tell you, he took that and he took it pretty well. Like, he didn't know it was a joke, but like, we put him through hell through this fucking car journey. And then when he got there, I said, yeah, how was your car journey? And he goes, oh, it was a little long. And I go, did Del treat you all right? And he goes, let me put it this way. My life is richer for meeting him.
That's a political statement. Yeah. That's a political answer if ever I heard one.
Well, it's funny because you forget what type, like when you just hang out with comedians and other people in show business and other stuff, you forget what I'm an annoying person. I forget that I'm an annoying person because I hang around with other annoying people and we cancel each other out. But my kid just started a private school and they had a parent teacher, like where we all met each other, and there's a few beers and stuff, but I went along to that on Tuesday and no one liked me. I just was making jokes.
Well, maybe they were just uptight. Maybe
they were uptight, but it's like they're all in like, and they're like, I have to know these people for 12 fucking years now, right? True. So I was meeting everyone like, hi, I'm Jim. And I'm like, I guess I'm a bigger human being than I don't realize that because I hang out, you know, when you fucking hang out at the Comedy Store with TJ Miller and stuff like that, you don't feel like you're that big a personality. Right, you know what I mean? Right. And then you go into this thing with all the schools. And it's like one of the teachers came up and said, well, we're so happy to have your son here at the school. Obviously, this lady was doing it to everyone. I go, man, you must have met some shitty kids if you're taking my son in. Am I right? Just to nothing.
She must have been shocked.
Yeah, just nothing. And each parent was just like, I was fluttering around trying to introduce myself to everyone. I was like, oh, God. And me and my ex went out together. The mother and my son went out together. Right. And we still hang out. We're still good friends and everything. And so people were like, oh, you seem like a fun couple. I'm like, oh, no, I wouldn't date this woman. Oh, hell no.
Long over.
Yeah, oh, God, we're only happy because we're not together. Am I right? And we were just that fucking couple, this Larry. And also, I don't think the Australian accent helps the whole fucking thing either.
You know, I think it does, though, because if you look at the landscape, and we talked a little bit before the show debuted, when you came into the radio station, about the fact that people were saying, well, here's another guy on a late night show talking about current events when there's already The Daily Show and Samantha Bee and blah, blah, blah. And you made a good point of saying, well, no one says, oh, here's another sitcom when somebody goes on the air with another show.
No one ever goes, this is another sitcom. Oh, they're doing the same thing as the other sitcoms do, trying to make us laugh through a formula.
With their jokes and their situations. But do you think it helps being from another country as an outsider coming in and commenting on what's happening in America?
I think it helps.
Because you got Trevor Noah, who's a South African.
Samantha Bee's Canadian.
Right. You got Oliver,
John
who's
Oliver's
a Brit.
British. Michelle Wolf's American, I think.
Yeah, I think she is.
She's Canadian or anything. I'm pretty
but do you
sure
think there's
American.
A difference one way or the other? Does it help or hurt?
No, I think it does help. I think it gives you a little bit of leeway in, especially how I perform it. I always try to play, this is fairly natural, but I always try to play confused and just like, I want to know, why is this happening?
Right.
Right. Where I feel like if you were born here your whole time, you have no excuse to be as confused as I am on stage. Right. So So for me, it gives me a little, a sideways argument to things. And then also throughout the show, I do little weird things that I guess other hosts could, like I bag on New Zealand a lot. Right.
Well, you're Australian.
Yeah, I know, but that's the whole thing. I always think like Americans don't care about New Zealand, so I can say whatever the fuck I want about New Zealand. I also think I say things about Australia occasionally that are probably factually untrue. that no writers pull me up on fact checking. Yeah, I said that our military arsenal this year in Australia was called a Wonga Wonga. It's not called that.
No.
It's not called that. I think
which is Aboriginal for a giant hidden sword.
Giant hidden
right?
treasured sword of sky or something. Wonga Wonga. I think it's either a town or Wonga Wonga, or it's a name of a bird. And I don't know if it, like, now I might be completely wrong, and this may even be slightly racist what I'm saying, but I was always told that whenever you heard, like there's a town in Australia called Wagga Wagga, and then there's like a Wonga Wonga, and I heard it's because the Aboriginals, how they counted things, they never went 1, 2, they just said things twice.
Oh, wow.
So you have two Wongas, you got a Wonga Wonga, and three of them are Wonga Wonga Wonga.
Oh, I got you.
I don't know. That I may have been fed some bullshit there, but yeah. That's what I've heard.
Well, hopefully none of my Aboriginal listeners will take any offense to what you just said.
They may do. Who knows?
This could be my breakthrough. This could be the thing. That might be conspiracy. Do you like the in-studio stuff better than the field stuff? Do you like
I like in-studio. I have more fun in-studio. The field stuff, sometimes especially when you're doing a field piece and you're speaking to a person that you don't agree with, sometimes I feel guilty that I'm trying to make them slip up.
Oh, I see.
And then
feel like you're like, trapping them.
Yeah, I feel like, and I don't feel like I'm like Ali G or something like that. Right, you know, right. I'm not like Borat trying to make him look like a complete idiot. I'm asking them questions, in the hope that they will give me an answer that I want to have as a soundbite. And it's like, I'm not trying to trick them into the answer and stuff, but I do feel like sometimes they say something and you go, ah, fuck, right? Like you've slipped up, you know, and then there's other people that you don't want them to slip up and then they do. So it feels like a little bit. So we had this one guy and we never aired this and we were talking about the Great Barrier Reef. And this guy, if you were to look at him, he was like one of the heads of tourism for Queensland, right? And if you looked at him, you'd go, oh, this is a fucking burly fucking white guy, you know what I mean? And he couldn't have been a more measured and tolerant person to talk to when you were talking about. He goes, and he was there going, I'll tell you what, you'd think this guy would probably hate Muslims. He looked like the type, right?
Right.
But he goes, tell you what, he goes, I went over to fucking, I don't know, Saudi Arabia or something like that. He goes, and was it during Christmas? They played Christmas carols over there. They were more tolerant of me than we are of them in Australia. Like he said things like this, right? And, like, and then he's talking about the reef and he goes, all we want is tourism to be good and people to enjoy the reef, but to take care of the reef and all that, you know, yeah.
You're not giving me anything, pal.
You're not giving me anything. And then I just went out of, I go, who do you think hurts the reef more? And I said, Asians, Mexicans. Asians, Mexicans, or Muslims, right? I don't know where this question was. And then he thought about it and he goes, ah, probably Asians. And I go, why? And he goes, ah, oh, they're always stepping on it and kicking it with their little feet. It's probably all that karate they do. And I went, God, no. And then I knew he was joking, but I could have fucked him up out of context.
Yeah, you could have edited that.
I could have edited that in and fucked this guy up. And he was one of these guys who worked in tourism.
Right.
And like, and we decided that he was such a nice fan. And I know he didn't mean it like that. So I edited it out. I made sure it wasn't in the piece.
Do you have to make calls like that all the time where you're erring on the side of decency over laughter, which is hard
sometimes?
Yeah,
you want to, look, I'm not in the business of fucking people over, you know, so I don't want to do that to, yeah. Yeah, of course there's, you know, look, sometimes there'll be things in the show that one of our writers will write and, you know, so in that last thing I do a thing about, I said like Dennis Rodman is our secret weapon. He knows Kim Jong-un and lots of stuff. And as we said, we call the Australian secret weapon a Wonga Wonga.
Right.
Right. And one of our writers, who's incidentally one of our black writers, said to me, he goes, why don't you say Dennis Rodman's our Wonga Wonga? And I go, I know we're not saying anything racist there, but that sounds like a racist thing.
It's way too close.
If Dennis Rodman's our Wonga Wonga, I go, you could say that joke, but I could never get away with that joke, even though it's a made up word and a, you know what I mean? So there's often little calls like that, but I do find with the writers, because some people often now, like they say, like diversity has gone crazy that you have to have, so a writer's room for comedy needs definitely to be diverse. You need to have women in there. You need to have men in there. You need to have black people in there. You need to have Hispanic people. You need to have it, because otherwise you get into this little vacuum, this little thing where you think you're saying the right, you know, you need people to pull you up every now and again.
I think it's good in media in general, because even the TMZ thing that just happened with Kanye West and that black guy who was working in the TMZ newsroom stood up and called him out on that 400 years of racism, of slavery was a choice thing, you know? Yeah. And if you don't have someone representing that culture, I don't think you can make that stand.
Because when I heard that Kanye West said that, my instant reaction was, no, that's not true. I wanted to know what he meant by it.
Right.
Because maybe there was a follow-up thing where he goes, but he didn't seem to have a follow-up. Oh, no. It just seemed like...
He just said eventually you think they would have gotten tired of being slaves, and there were so many of them, they should have just said no, you know?
Yeah, it's just a choice.
Not really the way it works.
Yeah, he seems to have lost his mind, Kanye, hasn't he?
Yeah.
But then there's always a bit... There's sometimes with people like that where I'm like, maybe he's playing us all. Maybe this is going to sell him albums...
He's got new music he's trying to sell, so it seems like
it was like I started to catch on towards the end of the Joaquin Phoenix or Joaquin or however you say his name.
Joaquin Phoenix?
Joaquin, I think. Yeah. When Joaquin Phoenix was playing that crazy guy and he's going on Letterman, he said he wanted to be a rapper and he had a big beard, and towards the end before there was the reveal, I was like, no, this is a prank now.
Yeah.
Because it was getting a bit weird. And I'm starting to feel with Kanye like maybe he has a reveal for us.
Maybe. I know. He's got a crazy look in his eyes, though.
He's got a crazy look in his eyes. And up until, like, even 2 years ago, I think he was in Sacramento or something, he did, like, two songs and walked off.
Yeah. Well, he said he was on opioids back then. That was the problem.
Was he on opioids?
That's what he claims, yeah.
Yeah.
After his liposuction.
That's it. Oh, after his lipo. He had lipo and then got on opioids.
Yeah.
But see, that's the other thing with Americans is the fucking pill popping, and the pill popping thing. It only exists because you don't have public health care, because you have people making money off the pills, and also people prescribe more pills if you see a doctor more times. It isn't in cultures like Australia and Britain. We're old fashioned. We're heroin addicts and cocaine problems
and booze, plenty of booze.
But this pill popping thing is a distinctly American. Like I remember, like going, what? He's addicted to prescription, and this has been going on since fucking Elvis.
Yeah, you're right.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's a distinctly American thing, and also like I take Xanax on the road. To help me sleep in different time zones. Because if you're flying across America and then all of a sudden I got to do a show and I got to be on a plane early and stuff like that, just so I can go to sleep when I need to go to sleep. And I have to be conscious because that's super addictive. Like when I get home, I'm like, I could just pop one and go to sleep now. And it's like
instant fix.
Yeah. You got to fight that little will to do it. And I just watched that Elvis documentary and that was the whole thing, that he started doing that as an entertainer. So after he did a show, he could go to sleep and then he needed something that might wake him up. And you know, I get why it's, you know, look, and my mother's an elderly lady now, and she's had pain and different surgeries and stuff like that, and they have her on Oxycontin for, you know, you're in your late 70s, early 80s or whatever. That's like
enjoy, right?
Part and parcel of the fact. That's why when I look at like The Last Man on Earth, I love that TV show, right? When I watch Last Man on Earth, I'm like, I would be an Oxycontin addict. I'd just be stopping at every fucking pharmacy.
You'd be doing all the drugs all the time.
Yeah, no job to wake up to, no family responsibility.
I would
just be like, I know it would shorten my life, but what do you got to do? I wouldn't commit suicide, but I would be a fucking smack all the time.
Speaking of responsibilities, Hank, your son.
Yeah.
Has that changed your outlook in general?
Of course.
When I had my kid, I felt like I was changed on like a cellular level. Like things were even out of my control. I changed in ways I didn't even choose to change, because you're just, if you're a decent human being, it takes on a whole new level for you, right?
There's even when I do stupid shit or go out and get drunk or whatever and wake up with a, I feel guilt now, and I never used to feel guilt.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm more responsible. Since breaking up with his mother, I've become a better father. And I know a lot of people say that to justify their breakup or whatever like that. But I wasn't really, before that, for the first 4 years of his life, I wasn't really parenting at all. I was just a guy living with a 4-year-old. Like I thought I was parenting because I was very nice to my son. I played with my son. I loved my son and all that type of stuff. But she was doing all the bathing him and putting him to bed and getting him up in the morning and all that type of stuff. But right. I went off and earned money, you know. And now that I have him and it's just me and him and I have him every second week, it's like, it's fucking not easy, man. It's a hard gig.
Yeah.
Like just little things like you have to remember to feed them.
They're funny that way. They like to eat all the time.
No, but it's not even just that you like to eat. Can you imagine? Because we've been adults for so long, just not, like another person responsible for feeding you. You know what I mean? When I eat, I go off, I get food, or I'm hungry, I go get some food, or I think oh, I'll stop off at this drive-thru, or I'll order some food, or I'll make some food.
You can leave a bowl out on the floor, I guess, and let your kid just graze, but
It's like my son's like, Dad, I want some water. And you're like, get some water. All right. I better get you water.
That's important. Feeding and water. Yeah. Those instructions.
They play that fucking water thing. Kids play that.
Oh,
thing.
Yeah.
Right before they go to bed, I'm thirsty. Mm-hmm. Are you?
Daddy.
Because you don't want to be that person that goes, no, you don't need more water because water's like.
How can you refuse someone water?
Yeah. How can you refuse someone water? Water's also so cheap and all that type of stuff. It's like, all right, because I'll believe that lie every single time. I need more water.
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
But yeah, I love being a dad. I would, even when I was breaking up with my ex, I proposed to her, but she didn't propose, but not like in that way. I would have had a second child with her, so my kids were both, you know, like fully related, and
right.
they could go through life together, going from one house to the other, rather than being separate mm-hmm. parents and that type of stuff. But I would have had another one, even during the breakup,
just to give him a sibling. Yeah.
And also, I understood that she was a good mother, and that was never any problem I had. And I feel like. I had a child with someone that I was very lucky to have a child with this person because, mm-hmm. you know, and we still are good friends now. And it has moving forward. I don't, being a single dad, it is hard to date and stuff like that. Like women do get cautious of someone with a kid. I get that as though.
Yeah. Really. I think it's respectful to not want to the kid,
yeah.
you know, because you don't want to mess up a kid's life. You can,
yeah.
you can fool around with a human being who's an adult and, you know, if things go south, whatever, things get shitty, that's okay. But you don't want a kid involved. I don't think.
Yeah. So I'm very protective of who, like introducing my children
yeah.
to any new people or anything like my child, any new people. So it's, and also it takes up a lot of your spare time. So you start dating and then it's like, it's like, you know, at least every second weekend, I'm like, no, I'm just spending it with my kid. And,
mm-hmm.
and then every other weekend, I'm off fucking doing gigs around the country. And,
yeah.
But you know, I'm seeing my son today. I'm picking him up from school today and I'm going for like the next 5 days. And at the end of those 5 days, when I drop him off, I'll be like this, great. And I'll drop him off his mate and I'll feel like a sense of relief. And then like 15 minutes into that car ride, I'll be missing him.
Yeah.
Right away. But like towards the end of these 5 days,
it's exhausting.
Like,
absolutely.
It's exhausting.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's exhausting. And like also it's like your life is 3 times messier than it is without them. It's like my cleaner knows when
it's chaos.
Chaos.
Yeah.
And I'm also, I know stricter parents that like, no, they have to have their toys up in their room. I kind of like the toys all being around because that means that they're playing around you. You know what I mean? Like, because you can't see, I can't remember a time my parents sat on the ground and played toys with me. I can't remember it.
Hmm.
And I think it was, they were working all the time. It's not like my parents weren't unloving or anything like that. I just can't remember that. And so I try to play with my son a lot, but sometimes I just want to watch a fucking Dodgers game. So if he's playing with his toys, I want him to be in the living room with me playing with his toys right. rather than off in a special room. So I put up with the mess all around me.
And how about if someone told you in a house you were living in that you could only put your shit in your bedroom? You couldn't have anything of yours in the living room or anywhere
exactly,
else, you know?
Exactly.
I feel like they're part of the family. They deserve the run of the house.
I've
right?
just gotten used to stepping on fucking Lego all the time. So it is fucking Lego, man. Lego, I don't even get it.
Is that his thing?
He's mad for it, but it's what is so weird about it is it's like once you make the giant Lego structure, it's going to break within a day.
Right.
The little bullets and stuff are going to fall off it and the little things and it's going to break. So it's really just the making of it that's the fun. And then it's just a pile of fucking pieces and never gets seen right. again.
It's like when I was a kid, we used to make plastic models. And once you're done with it, it's like, what the fuck do you do with it now? Yeah, you put it on a shelf?
You're going to look at it.
Yeah. Jim, I often put out feelers to my audience and have them suggest questions sure. for the people that I talk to mm-hmm. because it saves me a shit ton of work and I'm basically lazy. So I thought we'd burn through some of these if you don't mind. All right. This first one comes from Jamie Walton. She writes in, which is worse, the U.S. or Australia and why?
They both have their pluses and minuses.
Are you a citizen? Are you a U.S. citizen?
I plan on being.
You plan on being?
The wheels are in motion.
Oh, I got you.
Which is better than you? Okay, so Australia's got better food.
Better food in Australia.
Better food in Australia. Huh. Better food. I think, and I've traveled the world. I think the best food in the world is Australia.
Wow. There's
just things like, okay, first of all, in America, bread shouldn't last weeks. Milk shouldn't last fucking a week. Should last 3 days. Bread should last a couple of days.
I see what you're saying.
You're just pumped full of fucking chemicals and shit like that.
Yeah.
But Australia just has like better seafood and just like stuff that you can't help. And your bread sucks dicks over here. I think America is a better place to travel around. I think America has a more interesting history. And there's things like if you're a kid, you've got the stuff like Disneyland and all that fucking fun shit. The thing I like most about America is probably how fucking plastic it is. I love all your big fucking, just walking around Universal City Walk. I'm like, this is fucking insane. All these big fucking things hanging off buildings.
The whole country looks like a set.
Yeah, the whole country looks like a fucking movie set. But like, I think the beaches in Australia are better. I think, and this might sound a bit misogynist, I think the women, I probably like American women more. Yeah, I probably like American women a little bit more. But that might just be because there's fucking 150 million more of them to choose from.
Perhaps that is. I've heard, however, that Australian women love American men. I've never been, but
I think that the Australian accent grates on my ears slightly more than the American accent because I've lived away from it so long. So if having sex with an Australian woman is going, oh, I'm really enjoying that. Oh, good. That to me isn't sexy, where you guys might find the accent exotic. I find it just the opposite.
An erection killer.
Yeah.
All right. Jennifer Withers wrote in, my husband and I just saw Jim's show in Madison, Wisconsin on the 28th of April, and he was fantastic. However, he was not feeling well, so I'm hoping he's feeling better and thank him for not canceling the show.
Ugh.
I apologize for Green Bay. Please come back to Madison again soon. I'm guessing hangover? Who you
No, this is I told you this before. I had a prostate infection.
Oh, was your prostate issue?
I could hardly sit and I could hardly walk, and one of my testicles is swollen up. I had to actually cancel my Conan appearance that Monday because I couldn't sit and I couldn't walk and we didn't, and the doctors thought it might be cancer or something, but we had all the tests in. We're pretty sure it was just a prostate infection. And then they thought it might be an STD and all sorts of stuff. Anyway, so I had a lot on my mind before that Madison gig and before the Conan. And it's funny because someone wrote some article about I didn't show up on Conan because I was hungover, and that it wasn't fucking true. I've never missed.
I was going to say, you probably never missed a gig in your life because of hangovers.
Fucking, I would do Conan if I was fucking trashed out of my fucking head. I'd still show up. I just couldn't. I was even like, if I started seated, I could have done it, but I couldn't do the walk out to the chair. And I just, I wasn't in a place in my head where I could have even been funny that day.
Right.
I was under so much pressure. And anyway.
Paul writes, with the Comedy Central show, how much freedom are they giving you to say and do what you want on the show? Have they been pretty easy?
We do get notes, but for the most part, we're a very hard show to give notes on. Their notes always the same thing. Yeah, we want it to be, you know, more Jim's point of view or something like that. It's always these wishy-washy. But we're a very hard show to give notes on because our script isn't done till late Monday night and we're filming at like 11 o'clock on Tuesday. So there's not much they can do. They sometimes, their notes, if it is anything, is like, please don't do that rather than we would rather you do this. If that makes sense.
Yes.
So
they're cutting stuff out, not telling you.
Pretty good. And I think, and this might be, if we get another like 30 episodes next year, I think the notes will become even less because it's like, once they contract you that many episodes, what the fuck are they going to do? They can't.
Right. Well, they can make your life miserable by writing.
They can make your life miserable. But for the most, as long as our ratings are right, they're leaving me alone, yeah.
Eric Weiss wants to know, since the anti-gun segment that, of course, blew up on YouTube, yeah. Was there any backlash with your audience? Did you lose any audience?
I lost a lot of audience, but I gained more than I lost. But my audience did shift. My age group of people that came to see me shift, and my demos became far more multicultural than they were before.
Well, that's a good thing.
And not just multicultural, but there's more women showing up to the shows now than there has ever been. There used to be like 70% men at my shows, and now it's probably 69% men or something.
Do you think your material has shifted as the audience has changed?
No, my material hasn't shifted. My material shifted with age more than anything.
Because you're not talking about the stuff you cared about when you were 20 years old.
Yeah, my routines used to all be about taking cocaine, having one-night stands, and because that was my life for years. And now, of course, there's stories about being a dad, and there's stories about, now there's going to be a story about having a fucking infected prostate. I didn't have that before,
Michelle writes in, she says, speaking of gun control, do you worry about Hank going to school in the U.S. with all the guns in this country?
I do, but like with anything, it's something that, it's out of my hands. There's nothing you can really worrying about things. Doesn't help you achieve anything. And right. I've been a worrier my whole life, so I try not to worry about that. I think he'll be fine, but I am very protective of him. And, I think everyone's got to be concerned about it. You have to have that conversation with your children.
Yeah.
One of the many sad things about the school shooting is there's not a lot of advice to, the advice you can give is don't try and be a hero. Fucking get the fuck out of that classroom if you can just keep do what the teacher tells you or whatever, But it's like, it is a very helpless situation. It's like someone trying to give you advice. If you get cancer, this is the advice. There's not a lot of advice you can give people. They'll deal about how they do,
I did one segment on this show where I talked about, in my belief, the life of one child is worth more than all the rights to own a assault weapon.
I believe that 100%. I believe,
and
yeah.
I got blowback for it. I got a lot of people pushing back.
Well, it's like, of course, the sad thing that happens with lives, and this happens during war as well, is you have to go, how many lives are saved by one action that kills? There is collateral damage in anything that happens in weaponry in this world. It's like the bombing of Hiroshima. Did it save substantially more lives through doing that? And there's arguments, yes and no, and all that type of stuff. And of course, people had to beat the fucking Nazis and all that type of stuff. But I'm not a believer that, when you hear that story about when a good guy with a gun saved the day, I believe that they're far outnumbered by bad guys with guns fucking ruining days.
Yeah. Chris Vaughn wants to know, is comedy dying due to the ever-growing rise in political correctness?
No, comedy's not dying. And comedy's actually stronger than it's ever been. And from the 18 years I've been doing, this is the strongest the comedy circuit's ever been, at least in America. I think it's died down a lot in Britain. I don't believe that political correctness are hurting comedy at all. What I believe is the problem with it is the world's just as politically correct as it's ever been. It's just that we fucking hear from everyone. And
everything is overanalyzed.
We never used to hear from everyone. There wasn't forums that people write on all fucking day. And, it used to be like people who wrote into networks who actually got a pen and paper and write. Those people were really hurt.
Yes.
Those people were really, the network executives used to get fucking panicky about letters.
If you go to the business of sitting down and writing something, putting it in an envelope, putting a stamp on it and taking it to a post office, you that's serious intent. Now you do it all with a push of a button.
And
it's meaningless.
And now it's just a lot of noise. So we're hearing from everybody and now we're not listening to anyone.
What do you think? I got a couple of these questions. Adam Ridgewell, Dana Hockenberry. What do you feel about the thing with Michelle Wolf? You mentioned her in the White House correspondence dinner. I mean, she is getting.
Okay. Well, what I feel about Michelle Wolf is, first of all, on this show, we criticize the way that men look all the fucking time. I think it was Rex Tillerson or don't know who it was. We said, look like he'd had two strokes to even his face up. You know what I mean? like that's pretty.
That's brutal. It's pretty brutal. Hilarious.
Like we knock the way that Trump looks all the time, and he's a funny looking fella. And so, you know what I mean? So I don't think she was that mean about Huckabee. And I think with equality, maybe if I was doing the White House Correspondents' Dinner and, there was talk of me doing it, I didn't particularly want to do it because I thought that was more of a minefield for me to tread through.
Right.
But I think Sarah was the right comedian. Michelle was the right comedian at the right time to be doing this. And I stand up for every joke she fucking said. And also, if you're dumb enough to think that just hasn't made that girl a star, like I haven't talked to her, but she must be enjoying the fuck out of this. If you think for a second controversy and comedy, that we don't feed off that, you're ridiculous. If you think, well, this is a travesty. How dare she? No, that's the, if
her price just went up.
Yeah, if you don't like that person, you just ignore them.
Yeah.
Ignore them is the only way that we go away.
You kill them with silence.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, this comes from Stephen Greening. I think I know the answer to this one. What's the worst heckle you've received and how do you deal with it? Well, Manchester would have to be the
Manchester,
worst heckle.
Manchester got punched in the head. One time I was being heckled by a guy, and another time I was being heckled by a guy in an audience who kept on heckling. And then I said, all right, fine. And I kept on responding to this man who heckled. And then the security weren't doing anything. They weren't doing anything at all. So I said, turn the house lights up. I want to see this person. I said, stand up. Who's doing it? And it was a Down syndrome fella.
No way.
And then the audience was like, and I was like, ah, oh, fuck. Right. And so then, of course, you back away.
Yes.
Of course, that wasn't my intent. But before it was just a voice in a dark room. And so that was the most awkwardest situation it ever gotten.
And note to self, never turn up the house lights again, right?
Well, also, just blast also from the no, stage. Because people around me, normally you rip into a heckler and people around the heckler are laughing, and then there seemed to be a weird feedback coming from the audience. I'm like, this isn't going how it's normally meant to go. And also you're in a situation where you can't allow the person to continue heckling, no matter who it is. But if you don't know what you're dealing with, and often we don't know what we're dealing with, you know, because you're just talking into the darkness, especially if you're in theaters and comedy clubs, you can see everyone, but in theaters, you can't see shit.
Right.
And so that was the most awkward situation, but it was resolved very quickly and it was fine. And I said to the guy, hey, mate, can you stop yelling? He's like, no problem. And he sat down and we all went back on with our lives. But it was a weird thing up until then.
You probably get heckled less the more successful you are.
Well,
right?
I get heckled more because people want me to rip into them.
Oh, I got it.
But the heckling has changed in the extent that people used to heckle me because they wanted me to fail when you're in comedy clubs. They wanted to throw you off your rhythm. And now people heckle me because they want to see how I'll deal with the heckle, which is a different thing.
It's a badge of honor for Jim Jeffries.
Even the people heckling me want me to beat them up. So it's a weird sort of dichotomy, that one.
Do you enjoy that back and forth at all?
It depends where my brain is that day. Sometimes it's like mental gymnastics and you're like, oh, this is fun. I'll try to outwit a person or whatever. And, you know, but then sometimes it's like, I just want to get through this particular joke because it depends what joke you're interrupting. Mm-hmm. Some jokes is like, this is a long story and don't ruin the flow. And then, oh, they haven't. Then other things, it's like, oh, you can yell now. It won't bother me.
Right.
I can get the train back on the tracks pretty quick. Yeah.
All right. This is the last one. This is a three-part question. Three questions for Jim, writes Jeremy Bushell. He says, if you could have a drink with anyone, past or present, who would it be? Past or present, anyone ever. You could sit down and have a cocktail with anybody.
Probably John Lennon.
Lennon, really? Yeah,
probably John Lennon. It would be someone in, it would like Elvis Presley or John Lennon or something like that. It would be someone in music, I think I'd probably, you know, like when it comes to like, you know, like of course I would like to have a beer with George Carlin or something like that. But I feel like if I spoke to like Richard Pryor or George Carlin or, you know, any legend of comedy or something, and this, I'm not saying I'm a legend of comedy, but I'd already have too much in common with them.
You know that world.
I wouldn't fanboy out as much as if I met someone that is just like, what? You're fucking Elvis, man.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I always feel that way about Sinatra. If I could have sat down and had like Jack Daniels with Sinatra, that would be a perfect evening for me.
Right up there in that list. Sammy Davis Jr. probably. And then there's the sensible answer. I would like to, more than any of those people, I'd probably like to have a beer with my father when he was the same age as I am now. Or my grandfather at the same age that I am now.
Yeah.
And maybe them not know what I know. You know what I mean? Just see.
Or not know who you are.
Not know who I am. Yeah. Just see if that's someone that I would have. Like the whole premise originally of Back to the Future was if you were in high school with your dad, would he be being one of your mates?
Right.
That was the whole sort of starting point for Back to the Future. And I think that would be more interesting than meeting anybody. It would be just fucking meeting my dad in a pub when he was 40 or whatever. Even when, let's say when we were both 25, because I remember him when he's 40.
Do you think that comes more also with becoming a dad, that that makes you think along those lines? Because I think about that now a lot, and I maybe not so much when I was that age.
I think so. I definitely look back on when my father was my age, I was the same age as my son is now. So I sort of remember my dad being, and my brothers are older, so they had him younger than I did, but I sort of remember my father being this age now. And I remember him coming home from work and I don't remember him. I don't remember him fucking acting like a peanut, like I fucking act like, and I don't remember him worrying about being a dad constantly, but I assume he was. And because Hank doesn't know that I worry about being,
you know, you never show the kids the worries.
I've never shown him for a second that I have any fucking doubt what I'm doing as a fucking parent.
Mm-mm.
And, I assume that he has had that doubt. And if I could have hung out with him then, you know, like if my dad at this age went to Vegas, would he go as crazy as when I go to Vegas? Or would he, I assume he would have, but I didn't see him like that.
Right.
And now, I see him, he was not carefree, but now he's like this carefree old fella, you know, he just doesn't give a fucking rat's ass. He's just a carefree old bloke.
That comes with age.
Yeah.
It's one of the only good things that come with getting old.
I believe that about depression. You can't beat depression. You can just outlive it. There's nobody in their 90s who's depressed. No one's in their 90s going, I can't get out of bed today. If you can get out of bed, you fucking get out.
Right.
And people in their 20s and 30s are like, not today.
Who was the person who led you to your career in entertainment? Was there one person, teacher, friend?
There was a comic that I looked up to immensely that you wouldn't know, called Anthony Morgan, who at that stage was to me like meeting Lenny Bruce. He was this Australian comic who was fucking on the outside of the rest of the circuit, who did these little gigs. It was edgy and bold. And that was the person that I went and saw him like at 17 with a fake ID. And I remember thinking this person's like, well, he was like a magical person to me.
Mm.
You know? I give my mum very little credit in most interviews and stuff like that, but I'll give my mother a lot of credit for me being in the entertainment business, because she pushed me to do, I was such a shy kid, and she made me do things like school musicals. She just made me.
Hmm.
Just like how a dad might make you fucking join a sports team, even if you don't, you know. And so I remember being, and at the time thinking it was torture, I remember being like physically ill at like 14, 15, having to get up and sing a song in front of people in front of the school. Physically feeling, but I just did it so much that by the time I wanted to be a stand-up comedian, I had no fear of being on stage whatsoever. But that was through my teen years, just being forced into doing something. So maybe my mother was a bit of a show mum in that respect. Not in the respect that we were never made to do adverts and she never put me in a casting agent, but my mother made me do school musicals. So I distinctly remember that being a very panicky thing. And I think you should have to stretch yourself. I think the idea that there's people in this world like there's people like Michael Jackson who could just get up and sing and dance at like 7. He also had an extremely abusive father that probably didn't hurt things. Fear can make a person do some magical stuff.
That's true. You're afraid of getting beaten with a belt at the end of it. Sometimes that's good motivation.
Yeah. I look at my son now and I think positive reinforcement can take you so far. I am going to push him to do things that are out of his comfort zone. I'm never going to you know, moment my kid's about to get the training wheels taken off and he just doesn't want to ride a bike. He's so scared of falling off. I just have to keep pushing him down the fucking hill, even though he doesn't, because he will thank me eventually for this.
Yeah. I'm the worst with that because I have a daughter. And so naturally fathers want to wrap their daughters in bubble wrap and never let anything hurt them. And we were learning how to ski and she was getting very frustrated. She started to cry and she wanted to quit. And I was right there. I was like, well, fuck it. If she doesn't want to go skiing, she won't go skiing. But her mother was like, no, you're going to keep doing this and you're going to break through and you're going to love it. And sure as shit, she did. So I got to get better about that.
Yeah. It's a toughie though, isn't it? Cause you don't want to be mean to the kids.
You want them to be happy all the time.
One of the best bit of parenting advice that I had with my manager, Andrew, in Australia, my Australian manager, who is a single dad as well. And I've known him since his son was 5 and his son's a 20-year-old man now. And I remember saying to him about my son that I had to take my son to get some more immunization shots. And it was that age where he, you know, knew when there was going to be a big fucking needle put into him, and the kid was terrified. And I was like, ah, oh, fuck, why couldn't this been on his mother's week? You know what I mean? Like, why does that have to be my week? And the best advice he gave me, it sort of served me well since then, is you want to be there during the good times and the bad. They'll remember that. They'll remember that when it was hard, you were there, and they remember when it's that, you know, like, fuck, kids don't remember when you showed up to their sporting events, but they definitely remember when you didn't show up.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there was some stupid line in Modern Family where they go, where Ed O'Neill's character goes, 80% of parenting is just showing up. And I think that's probably true. If you're there, you're doing most of the job already.
Right.
And it's those people that don't show up that are fucking up, you know?
Last question. Who would you like to see past or present in a live set or performance? So this could be...
Oh, George Carlin. No doubt.
Carlin?
George Carlin is the best comic that ever lived and ever will be. There'll be no one... Okay, maybe, because I can't speak about the future, maybe there'll be someone who is just as good, but there'll never be anyone better, because that was perfect. He was perfect in every way. His stagecraft, the fact that he could do political and he could do silly, he could do a little bit of physical, and he was just like when you talk about LeBron James being so much better than every other basketball player in the league, it's like, that's what, in my opinion, that's what he was. And I only sort of got to know about George Carlin years after I'd become a comic. You know, we never had HBO specials in Australia. They never got sent to us. You know, the first time I saw a stand-up comic doing more than 5 minutes was Eddie Murphy's Delirious, and that's because that was a cinematic release.
Right.
So you could hire that on video, but we didn't have comedy specials in Australia on a channel. We didn't have a channel that you could swear on or anything, you know. And so my first exposure to George Carlin was Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure as Rufus, the time-traveling hippie or whatever the fuck he was, you know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
I'm not great friends, but I get along. I'm friends with Kelly's daughter, if she hears this or whatever, but we chat a bit on Twitter and what have you. And she's been to a few of my shows. And if I know Kelly's just been to one of my gigs, I get nervous. Like, that wasn't a great one. And Kelly was watching it. And that's just his daughter fucking watching me.
Yeah.
I get intimidated, you know, so it's, yeah, I think that was the best comic that I've seen, just watching his clips. And I never got to see him live. I never experienced that. And if he lived for maybe a year and a half or 2 more years more, I would have. I've just started to live over here in America, and that's something I would have done. And there was times when I was like on radio shows where he was there like the week before I was there. And it's like, you know, I just knew very soon our paths were about to cross, but I never got to meet him. I never got to see him perform live.
His use of words, unparalleled, I think, right? His use of the English language, just...
Yeah, what I do is so much more shambolic than what he does. So much more messy. What he did was clean and perfect, and it was like watching, you know, when there's good cooks and good chefs, and then there's these people who are just like, you can't teach that. Like, in the Michelin star restaurants, where you're like, how the fuck did they make this look so pretty? And so he had that. And, I'd like to see that. There's no one else's, apart from that, I don't watch that much stand. I used to watch a lot of stand, but since I like to live in a bubble with stand up so that I'm not stepping on too many other people's toes, and
you don't want to be influenced one way or the other. Not
influenced one way or the other. Yeah. So.
How about musically? Would you like to see the Beatles live?
I wish I could have seen the Beatles. See, and also sometimes I've seen Paul McCartney live like maybe five times, and then you watch it and you go, well, I assume the people who are playing the instruments around him are as good as the rest of the Beatles were. So I feel like you're seeing the Beatles then, at least for his portion that he gave to the Beatles.
Right.
But yeah, I would have, of course, liked to have seen the Beatles, but I don't think anyone ever saw the Beatles at their peak. No one ever saw them at their peak because they stopped touring. And when they were getting sort of from Rubber Soul onwards, when everything was getting really interesting and more experimental,
Best music was never played live.
Best music was never played live. And also, no one ever, because back then it was just like they put three microphone stands up and they put a drum kit and the backstage might have said the word the Beatles, and no one ever saw that like Paul McCartney shows where the whole stage is screens of photos of him from his past thing and color coordinated with all that. You know, no one ever got to experience that. Like the Stones got to do that.
Right.
The Stones got to go from just doing these, you know, like the Shea Stadium gig with the Beatles was the first stadium. The speaker system was the town way that they announced the players on with.
Yeah, the PA system.
That like no one ever got to hear them properly.
Couldn't hear anything anyway with all the screens.
Yeah, so no one ever saw what that could be. And the fact is, if John Lennon wasn't assassinated, we all would have seen the Beatles. There's no way during the mid-90s they wouldn't have gotten back together.
Right.
Of course they would. And Paul McCartney's always said that they got together for a documentary, the rest of them. And they tried to record a couple of songs and, you know, I mean, there's no way that would have been a holdout that John would have been the guy that said no. We should now be talking about why the Beatles broke up again. You know what I mean?
You're right.
That would definitely be a conversation. There's no way.
And it probably would have been Yoko again, I'm assuming.
I don't know. See, like John broke up with Yoko while they were married. I don't know if that marriage would have lasted to this day either. It's like, but who knows? That's only speculation.
But if you could go back and see them at the Cavern Club or something, like that energy and that sort of at the birth of it, I think that would be a pretty cool experience.
I still get little chills about doing gigs where the Beatles performed here, you know, and there's more around Britain when you do that, you know.
Yeah.
So I just recorded my new special at the Hammersmith Apollo, and that at that stage was the biggest venue you could play in London, and that's, I want to say 4,000 seats,
yeah,
right? And that's the biggest place, and so the Beatles did 21 shows there in 15 nights. Right. And it was at that stage a record, the most amount of tickets sold for anything in London ever. And it's like, wow, the Beatles performed on this stage 21 times. And so that was still something very exciting. But only because it's the Beatles, because every other fucking artist has played there as well. It's one of the more famous venues in the world. And it's like, I used to get really pissy with comedy clubs in London. Not pissy, but when the owner, I used to roll my eyes when the owners used to go, Eddie Izzard used to play this club. And I was like, yeah, because he wasn't born famous. I imagine he played every single comedy club.
Everybody has to,
you know what I mean? And I didn't get that when I played like the Grand Old Opry, knowing that all the Elvis was there and all that sort of stuff. I didn't get that chill, but I do. The Beatles is that one sort of mystic thing that, you know, Paul McCartney once, when I was at the Improv, was sitting in the corner and no one noticed he was there, and we were all told, like, McCartney's in the corner.
Wow.
And I was like, I was extra nervous. And like, I wasn't nervous in the sense that I couldn't perform, but I was like, every joke I checked to see if he was laughing.
That's funny.
And you're like, I hope he enjoys this. I'm like, what difference does it make? since when was I meant to have the same sense of humor as Paul McCartney? Why is that a thing? Does that, if Paul McCartney doesn't find me funny, does that legitimize me as a person? And it's like, in my brain at the time, it did.
Yeah, of course.
And I remember doing an anal sex joke going,
oh no.
That might be rude. Yeah. Paul McCartney might find this rude.
I should do some vegan material now. Maybe get on his good side.
Yeah, I'm going to rip out all.
Meat sucks, doesn't it, everybody?
Take out all that material about how, and like, I used to do a joke ages ago, which was like, it was slightly racist, and it was, I know it wasn't racist. Racist is definitely the wrong word. From the, but he would have, if he ever heard this joke, found it to be terribly offensive. Right. And then I was like worried, like if he's heard me say this joke. And it was when I was living in London and he was, marrying Heather Mills, who was the woman he divorced, lost like £80 million or something. Yeah. Right? And she had lost her leg. In a, I think a car accident or something like that.
Yeah. A motorcycle accident.
Yeah. And she had one leg and she had lost a leg. And I go, when he proposed to her, he went down on one knee, which is his nickname for her, right? Right.
So in the back of your mind,
I think I've done that joke on television. I'm like, oh, fuck, that might have gotten back to him that I did the one knee joke.
That's funny.
He went down on one knee.
And if he had rushed the stage and punched you like that guy in Manchester, that truly would have been the stuff of legend.
Yeah, he went down on one knee. It's still a funny joke. Like, you can't do it now. It's too. He's been remarried. He's fucking. I think he had a kid with that woman, though, didn't he? He had a kid and then got divorced. And so I'm sure he has to see her all the time. I don't know.
Yeah. She seemed like a bitch, didn't she?
She said, well, this is the thing about her. She was in her court case where she was trying to get more money. She said, oh, he never let me use a bedpan in the bed. He made me go. And it's like, he's Paul McCartney. There's a fucking ensuite, first of all.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, no, I don't care if you got one. Like, go up and fucking hop to the bathroom. You're not pissing next to me. If we're meant to be having sex the next day, I don't want to see me wife having a shit or a piss next to me in the bed and then just sliding it under going, I'll get that in the morning, honey. You know what I mean? Like how, like, yes,
it
no.
It doesn't seem like a ridiculous request. You're
that's
right.
Like, it's like if I was like, go fucking get your crutches.
Right.
Go over and, I'm not telling you you have to put your leg on, but you get your crutches and fucking go off to the bathroom.
They could probably hire a guy to stand out in the hall.
She was on Dancing with the Stars. If you can do the fucking can, you can fucking hop to the bathroom. That's what I would say to her.
Jim, you've been more than kind with your time. I've taken up enough of it. I want to thank you for making this possible today. It was really fun.
Thanks for having me, mate.